Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Ravenpuffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join our Facebook group, the Ravenpuff Common Room, and on Instagram at the Rambling Ravenpuffs.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/therambling ravenpuffs, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in. Grab your butterbeer and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Ravenpuffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
Today we're covering chapters 11 and 12 of The Chamber of Secrets, The Dueling Club, and The Polyjuice Potion. In these chapters, everyone gives Harry crap for talking to snakes, and no crap is given to Malfoy for summoning such a socially frowned upon creature. And once again, Harry refuses to tell a grown-up any pertinent information.
Yes, exactly.
And joining us again is your favorite Potterhead couple, Amanda and Kevin Wilson, the host of the Fox and the Foxhound Love, Marriage, and Harry Potter podcast. Thank you so much for coming back, Amanda and Kevin. We didn't scare you off.
Not at all.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having us. It's good to be back. Thank you.
What was it like, Kevin, reading these chapters again after you just have read the fourth chapter of Half-Blood Prince?
It's weird going back and reading these chapters because it seems like such a simple, safe world that you're in. And the things that are being revealed, they have stakes, but the stakes aren't quite as high. And so jumping back, it was like, oh, I remember when this series was safe and fun and didn't make me cry all the time.
Yeah, I still don't. I mean, I felt that these two couple of chapters were pretty intense. And since I'm the complete total newbie to any of this, so I guess if this is safe and fun, I'm intrigued to see where this goes.
Oh yeah.
And Amanda, what was it like revisiting Chamber of Secrets for you?
Well, it's, I guess when you've read the series several times, a lot of times the earlier books, like especially the first two, it's so like familiar, and there's like a home-like feeling about it. You know, it's I hate to scare you even more, Jess, but yeah, it's nice and safe and comfortable, and it's, Harry is still so naive about the wizarding world, which was kind of an interesting thing to see again, where he's like, what, I'm sure loads of people here can do it, you know. And now where we are in the series, it's, he never asks a question, really, seemingly, about the wizarding world again.
That's so it's funny that you, I was thinking about this chapter because, like I said, it was a little, in my humble opinion, darker than some others have been. And I've talked to several people that are like, listen to the audiobooks as like, oh, if I have nothing else to, you know, to listen to, or if I just need to, like, I had a crap day and I just need to chill out, I listen to these books. So I guess I could, as kind of like ominous as these couple chapters were, I could also feel a little bit of comfort in them, which sounds like a contradictory statement, but I'm going to stand by it.
Yeah, I totally get that for sure. And it's, don't get me wrong, if I think back to the first time I read this series, I think I probably felt very similarly to how you're feeling, like, holy, you know, what in the world is going on at this school? You know,
geez,
this is so threatening. And yeah, so I think that's totally understandable.
Yeah, the dueling club thing, which I'm sure we'll touch on, you know, as we get through the chapter. But I have a lot of questions about that, everybody. So.
Alrighty then. So yeah, we begin with chapter 11, The Dueling Club, which is Harry, like, still trying to process everything of Colin being petrified, but his arm is fully restored and Madame Pomfrey allows him to go. And he tries to find Ron and Hermione, And it's kind of a little hurt that they're not like gushing over him. Oh, how is your arm and everything? They're already in the bathroom, like trying to get the potion like up and started.
Yeah, they're TCBing. They're taking care of business. I can understand where like he's a little hurt, but I attribute this to Hermione being at the helm. Like, yeah, that would be great to like wait around and, you know, do all that. But we've got some very important work to do. So let's get that done.
And it seems that Dobby's visit has only confirmed like their suspicions of Draco Malfoy even more, because there's a sense of, oh, if it had happened before, Draco's doing it now, and Lucius must have been doing it, you know, in his time at Hogwarts.
It totally makes sense, you know, their logic with this. I think if I were in their shoes, yeah, I'd be like, holy moly, this is completely confirming my theory. And that's kind of a psychological phenomenon anyway, right? Like, we seek out, it's a confirmation bias. We seek out evidence that supports our theory. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, like when you buy a red car, you see a red car everywhere and you're like, everybody has a red car, which I'm just very simply explaining confirmation bias. But yeah, I think thus far, again, I always feel like I have to preface a lot of this when I talk, because it's like, I'm sure y'all three are sitting there going like, oh my God, if she only knew. But
that's the fun of it. You don't know.
I know, that's true. But thus far, I think it's the second time they've kind of made this mistake. You know, in the first chapter, the first book, it was assuming Snape was up to all this, like, all these malicious acts, when really, you know, we find out it's Quirrell. So they're kind of building this case against Draco a little unfairly. I'm still a little not convinced. I mean, I'm not a big Draco Malfoy fan, but I just don't think a kid... I don't fully comprehend the Chamber of Secrets quite yet. So I'll just say that as well.
And then there's a point where Ron says, you read too much, Hermione. And I'm like, how dare you, sir? There's never such thing as reading too much.
Exactly.
It's the same thing that everyone tells Belle in Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yes.
Which is why they're played by the same actress.
Right. The worlds are colliding.
You should see like the fan art of like a little like younger Hermione with a bell.
Oh, that's cute.
Like, that's take so my cute. Money.
But one thing I noticed in the panic of wanting some sense of protection or comfort in these uncertain times is that the sort of like Calistine talismans and amulets that are supposed to like have defensive charms in them are going all around.
How funny. I highlighted that too. That meanwhile, hidden from the teacher is a roaring trade in talismans, amulets, and other protective devices was sweeping the school. Longbottom, I think he's my boy, bought a large evil-smelling green onion and a pointed purple crystal, which as a person that tends to buy some crystals, I was like, what kind of crystal was that? Was that an amethyst or was that what? So I'm guessing, Amy, you're taking this somewhere, but I just thought that was...
No, not too much, just the psychological phenomenon of that we desperately grasp for, you know, comfort in these sort of superstitions in that sort of way, which I can't, you know, I'm not in a position, despite being pagan, to go into... like real detail of all of these things. And I've not been above creating my own little like protection / prosperity satchels that I kit that I with various herbs and rocks and carrying it in my purse.
I have some by my bed to help me sleep. I mean, I think it's just, you know, I don't see anything wrong with it. I mean, I'm not hurting anybody. You know, the thing I'm not doing, I'm not pulling anybody's hair out. I'm not like, you know, doing anything like that to create it. But I do like this. It also made me think of just different things that people reach for to comfort themselves. And I know this is a little different, but just kind of like in the world at large, the things we reach for when we kind of don't know what else to do. Not that we don't have like a year's worth of experience with something right now at this point. But
that's so true. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just a little thing, and it'll just be really interesting because Kevin, it's not anything super spoily or it's just a throwaway, but these sort of types of talismans will come up in book 6. So stay tuned.
Oh, cool.
Oh, you all are in book, what book did you say again? I'm sorry.
Book six. They're on Half Blood Prince.
Okay. I'm not even close to there right now. So I think an exciting thing after we're talking about the talismans is it's Christmas and we're, you know, the kids that are staying for Christmas versus the ones that are going home. And so but that's always an exciting thing to see in a Harry Potter story. You know, Christmas is going to something's going to happen during Christmas, the Christmas season.
Hogwarts Christmas is a whole mood and it's my favorite thing.
There are ASMR YouTube videos devoted to Hogwarts Christmas.
Wow. That's next level.
Yeah.
But one thing I noticed is Malfoy staying. Why is he staying? Because he gave Harry such crap for staying. Oh, you're staying because no one loves you. And like, why are you staying then, Malfoy?
I asked myself that question as well, because I think, you know, being a kid, not from like a super well-off family, it was like the kid, well, and I wasn't in a boarding school, so I don't know what I'm saying, but a lot of the people would go on like, you know, these elaborate vacations. I guess I'm of the age where it was cool to come back during the winter with like a ski jacket and your lift ticket on it. Like that was some like badge of honor. So I kind of thought Malfoy, just given the history through this story, I don't know why he decided to hang back as well, other than to just annoy Harry or something to do with the Chamber of Secrets. Those were the only two things I could kind of surmise. What about y'all two or anybody?
Yeah, Amanda and Kevin, what did you think?
You think about like the earlier interaction in this book with Lucius in Borgin and Burks, when it's not a warm, fuzzy family vibe that we get, you know? And I feel like I could see his parents being the type of parents that are like, we have social obligations and events, or, you know, we're hobnobbing with X, Y, and Z, so it's best if you just stay at school because otherwise you'll just be in the way.
This is true.
Yeah, it's kind of a cold, detached sort of vibe that we get in Borgin and Burks.
Yeah, we're dining with the minister and his wife, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
Fancy Dursleys. I'm like on a tirade against the Dursleys, it seems like. But you know how they kind of play.
I noticed by our Instagram page.
Yeah, I don't know. I just figure since we're living there and on the podcast, we might as well talk about it. But so they kind of play act at being these fancy people, and the Malfoys are, you know, have some stature in this wizarding world. So they probably do have like a whole, I don't know, thing that they, like Draco might be the Harry, you know, I'll be in my room making no noise, all of that. So.
Oh, I feel bad.
Of course. But then the next big section of this chapter is stealing from Snape. And I gotta say, Hermione's got balls.
Right? I literally was thinking as I actually listened to these chapters instead of reading them. And as I was listening to this part, I thought the exact same phrase. Hermione's got balls.
Exactly. She's just so matter of fact about it that, you know, obviously Snape hates her guts. He'll automatically be looking at Harry, less or so Ron, so I will steal it physically. And you guys just do what you do best and create a diversion.
She even tells them that she's the one with the clean record, which makes me wonder if maybe she had like a plan B if she got caught. Like maybe she already had a plan of what she was going to say if she got caught. Oh, well, I needed this one thing because I wanted to study it on my own or something.
Although that is a great point.
I don't see that working on Snape, though.
No, because Snape already hates her because of her association with Harry.
Yeah. But anyway, one thing. Where does it start? So what does Harry do? Harry takes one of the twins' filibuster fireworks and throws it into Goyle's cauldron and creates complete and utter mayhem. Again, as we end up talking about a lot with you guys when you come on the show, the notion of bodily harm.
It comes up a lot in these books.
And it keeps coming up.
Because Goyle's cauldron explodes, and anyone who is doused with any ounce of Goyle's potion, whatever it got contaminated, starts swelling. For Malfoy, it's his nose. For like some, it's their ears. Some, it's their hands and feet.
It's horrifying, the image, the mental image.
So much body disfiguration in this series.
Indeed. Yeah. That, I'm the Malfoy dragging his weight, the weight of his nose. The other thing that I kept thinking, like in this instance in particular, like, and then we just trust that like the parent, nobody's parents know, nobody writes a complaint, like nothing happens. Everybody just kind of goes about their business. Like there isn't a letter to Dumbledore. I don't know. I'm just so used to like people raising all kinds of hell if something like this were to happen. I guess it's a quick fix in the wizarding world. Like this is not permanent damage as far as I know. So it is just pretty wild. And the fact that Hermione is the one to cause all kind of this disarray is this honestly kind of surprised me. So
yeah, like, and Snape is just like, anyone who has been splashed come here for a deflating draft when I find out who did this.
Such a great Snape, as always.
I'm basically yes. just mimicking how Jim Dale does it.
Jim Dale's Snape is kind of great. Yeah.
It's just so different from Alan Rickman's like monotone. It's much more scathing.
It's like slimy, Jim Dale's Snape. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Hermione's able to get the boomslang skin and the things like that. And Snape finally is able to fish out the mangled remnants of the firework from the cauldron. If I ever find out who threw this, Snape whispered, I shall make sure that person is expelled. He knew it was me, Harry told Ron and Hermione as they hurried back to Moaning Myrtle's bathroom. I could tell. So what do you guys think? Amanda, Kevin, do you think Snape knew in some capacity?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And if so, why let him get away with it?
Well, I mean, he couldn't prove it, you know, and Snape's got to know that if he's going to pursue this plan of expelling the person responsible, it's going to have to go through Dumbledore. And there's like Harry's Dumbledore's special little boy. Like there's no way he would do that. First of all, there's no way he would do it even with proof, but definitely not without proof.
I feel like he's just waiting for Harry to do something that is so obvious that even Dumbledore himself will have to agree to expel Harry.
Jess, what do you think?
It was all very curious to me, and I couldn't really decide if Snape just let it happen and why. If he did let it happen, like, why would he? And then again, I kind of am like, well, there must not. I kind of do this a lot. I'm like, there must be something I don't know. Okay. And then I just kind of go forward. But it did all seem a little kind of like, yeah, he knew something was up. Why he kind of chose to let it happen, I don't know. Also, why he had this, I guess that they were messing with this potion anyway. So he had the deflating draft already on the ready. So interesting little scene, I thought, in this chapter. But the dueling club really threw me for a loop. And we're talking about bodily harm and we're setting up this club, which I think no surprise to me at the behest, I'm assuming, of Gilderoy Lockhart, because not a fan, that they're going to do this dueling club. And I started thinking, like, I was trying to put this in the context of like real life, which is probably not the point of reading this. But I was thinking, is it like fencing club? Like what is the motivation here other than just to give Gilderoy Lockhart a platform to, in his mind, he thinks, show off?
I think it's like a hybrid of fencing / self-defense.
Okay.
Because they kind of use their wands like saber swords.
This just seems like such a recipe for disaster. But I guess that I also have to remember in this, these kids don't know all the spells that are the most damaging quite yet, is my understanding.
Yeah, so there's insurance in that.
Right.
Yeah, I feel like if it was just two really rando kids that they showed us fight, Tommy Longbottom and, whoever.
Tommy Longbottom.
Jenny Cool Jeans or whatever. Then I feel like it would have sort of been a disaster. Like they try it, it doesn't work. Maybe a frog jumps out of the ground or something, very mundane. But they purposely put these two kids together that you know are more powerful than most of the other kids.
Yeah. So when they said, "I wonder who'll be teaching us," said Hermione as they edged into the chattering crowd. "Someone told me Flitwick was a dueling champion when he was young. Maybe it'll be him." And I just thought of that thinking, I want a Flitwick dueling club.
Totally.
I don't know if Flitwick was a hat stall officially, but it is in the canon, I think, that as McGonagall was on the ledge between Gryffindor and Ravenclaw and went Gryffindor, Flitwick was the opposite between Ravenclaw and Gryffindor and went Ravenclaw.
That tracks. I like that. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, so, yeah, I really want the Flitwick Dueling Club, but that is not what we get. We get, of course, who else? Gilderoy Lockhart, for all the reasons that Jess suggests he wanted a platform. But one thing that really I thought about was, you know, the fact that Snape is there. How did Snape getting there end up happening? Like, I'm thinking of all the potential theories. Did Lockhart ask him to be there as the sort of assistant to demean him? And did Snape accept this because he wanted to put Lockhart in his place? Did Snape offer without Gilderoy asking? And Lockhart just thought, oh, this is a way for me to show someone else up. Or was it more Dumbledore going to Snape is like, make sure Lockhart doesn't kill the kids? What do you guys think, Amanda, Kevin?
So when I think about it, who would have been the alternatives? Presuming that Lockhart is the one who approached Snape. You know, you figure Lockhart's definitely the type of dude who's like, well, I'm not going to duel a female. And then you go, okay, so that narrows it down to the potential males. He's not going to duel Flitwick if Flitwick is like a demonstrated champion, because he's like, oh, I'm definitely going to lose that. He's not going to duel Dumbledore because Dumbledore would be like, no. And it kind of only really leaves Snape, unless I'm just like forgetting someone super obvious.
What do you think, Kevin?
I kind of like that idea that Dumbledore told Snape, please don't let this guy destroy the school or kill one of these kids. He's such a liability. Yeah. He's such a nightmare.
What do you think, Jess?
I just kind of, you know, I kind of took it as Snape having an opportunity to just embarrass him. I feel like the entire staff at Hogwarts thinks that this guy's a joke, but for some reason he's there. So, and I never really got the, like, he's done so many mean just things to undermine the teachers and whatever. I almost think he's the type of professor that they're like, let's just take any opportunity, because they all know he's full of it because they're actually, you know, well versed. So I guess I thought it was a little underhanded of Snape to be there and just be like, all right,
is
I'll
Snape
make a fool
anything of this else but underhanded.
He's kind of Snapey. I don't know. He's
Snapey.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just think about it because if I go into deep Harry Potter trivia, so Snape is born in 1960 and Gilderoy Lockhart was born in 64. So they went to school together, Lockhart being a few years younger. So I'm just thinking, did Snape just, I guess in Lockhart's mind, didn't know Snape, you know, as a school classmate? At least Snape didn't have a reputation for being particularly very good at dueling. So I thought, okay, this is someone I can, you know, upstage and take on. Or again, is Lockhart just totally delusional in his own abilities?
I mean, Lockhart seems pretty delusional in like just life. I mean, from what I know of him, he's just just full of himself, thinks he knows everything, thinks he knows better. I don't know.
Amanda, Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, to me, the guy is just so full of hot air that you figure he had to be like that when he was Hogwarts age too. Yeah, I think that those colors shine pretty early.
I also wonder if Lockhart was maybe like a really meek, shy type of kid.
Ooh.
And then that insecurity ended up manifesting itself in him seeking, you know, celebrity and glory in that way.
Great point.
Yeah,
it's true. Before moving on, one thing I will make note of is, and I don't mind talking about Umbridge in this limited way because Jess knows quite a lot about Umbridge through pop culture. But in a way, Umbridge and Lockhart come from similar backgrounds where they're both half-bloods and both had, you know, muggle siblings. So it makes their ego so inflated. I'm so much better than everyone else.
Wow, that's a really good point. That's some deep HP knowledge right there, Amy.
I love it.
Does it? Yeah, when you want to write canon-compliant fan fiction, you need to know this stuff.
I love it. You're a scholar.
Anyway, I digress. So, now I don't want any of you youngsters to worry. You'll still have your potions master when I'm through with him. Never fear. And again, with the same with Umbridge. Do you want Snape to take them out or the other way around?
I will never root for Snape, but this is the closest I come.
So first they pair off in, you know, in their little group so that they can practice. Oh, wait, first comes the demonstration where Lockhart just falls on his ass.
Yes.
And I just think of, again, just the way Alan Rickman delivers all his lines. He says the curse so slowly and still Lockhart is thrown off his feet.
Expelliarmus.
Like, it's so slow. Like,
This did not come as a surprise to me. I was like, okay, well, I saw this coming. So where are we going now? Like, now that we're going to have children fighting, like, in some capacity, what's happening? What's happening now?
Lockhart's all just, if I had wanted to stop you, it would have been only too easy. However, I felt it would be instructive to let them see. Snape was looking murderous. Possibly Lockhart had noticed because he said, enough demonstrating, you know, get into pairs, go on.
Go ahead and kill each other, children. Enough demonstrating.
Yes. So I think one thing I noticed is Harry was not with Ron to begin with. Harry was who? With Neville? Or either way, somehow Ron and Seamus were together. And, you know, it has some description of Seamus being ashen face and Ron apologizing for his wand. And so it really made me realize just how much I thought it was more a improvisation of the movies that, as McGonagall put it, that Seamus Finnegan has this proclivity to pyrotechnics, but it was actually always here in the books.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah, because I thought it was just something that was inflated from that one instance with the charms class of levitating the feather and catching the feather on fire. But then I realized, oh, it's here too. Okay, this was always a part of Seamus.
I think in the movies, there's no other reference besides the feather. But yeah, so it's almost like they stayed with more fidelity to the books by saying that in the movie. I don't know.
In the Six Half-Blood Prince movie, they do, poor Seamus gets blown up again. But
oh, no.
Not a spoiler, Kev. It's not. It's not like he doesn't die or anything.
And Hermione is put with, was it Millicent Bulstrode?
Yes, and they describe her in a way, because I'm just kind of thinking of our Patreon, the scholarly Slytherclaws, and this is how she is described. Behind him walked a Slytherin girl who reminded Harry of a picture he had seen in Holidays with Hags. She was large and square, with her heavy jaw jutted aggressively. Hermione gave her a weak smile that she did not return, which I think it's a great way to describe this scene. And you can kind of see in your mind's eye, Hermione kind of being like trying to be, you know, politely friendly. And I don't know. I just thought that was an interesting, I don't have a copy of Holidays with Hags personally. I don't know what that's about, but it doesn't sound like a compliment.
Oh, yeah. I realized Harry and Malfoy were paired off from the very beginning. And again, Malfoy and Harry, you know, kind of throw off charms and jinxes at each other. Did anyone have any comments on this particular, you know, this back and forth with the groups?
Well, just, you know, Millicent Bulstrode at one point, like, Hermione's just like on the ground whimpering. Like, it's...
Oh, she's got her in a headlock?
My God.
I just envisioned this as like, you know, you start off, I mentioned previously I used to go to a boxing gym, and how one time sparring, which is, you know, just sparring, turned into a full-blown fight with a couple of the guys there. That's just kind of what I envisioned here, like people joyful, you know, kind of like just doing what they need to do, and then all of a sudden things just go sideways and you're like, we created chaos. Or like a food fight in a school, you know, cafeteria.
Yeah, I think that's accurate.
And so finally, they stop working in groups, and all the attention is now on Malfoy and Harry. And I'm just wondering, where did Malfoy learn this spell?
Right. That's
Serpensortia. Like, I don't think that that is an age-appropriate spell.
No, definitely not.
Okay, so I have, I gotta call this, like, something. I was gonna call it a dumbass Harry Potter question, but I don't think that's too nice. So I'll think of something better. So what is stopping, like, Lucius from teaching Draco these things? Like, Hermione's at a disadvantage. Her parents are muggles, so she's not going to be like, by the way, here's, you know, a secret spell that I learned. Is there, like, wizarding law against that? Or is that just something that, you know, I think the point is, where did Malfoy learn the spell? My automatic assumption was, well, probably his dad. Is there anything preventing that in the wizarding world? Not that, like, they would be against breaking laws, obviously, but...
Yeah, I think, well, as we already learned from, you know, in Diagon Alley, or should I say Nocturne Alley, Lucius Malfoy kind of considers him above the law and would happily teach his son these sort of spells. My question is, why is Malfoy drawing attention to himself by throwing out... If he had cornered Harry, like, in the hallway and wanted to be a bully privately, that's one thing you'd throw out this spell, but he's doing it in front of the whole school. His need for applause and appreciation trumps the fact that I should not be highlighting the fact that I know this.
I think it just shows you that he feels so untouchable.
Yeah.
He thinks he's completely untouchable by anyone.
Yeah, probably. We discussed the untouchability of Malfoy in our Mudbloods and Murmurs chapters, where, again, Hermione called out Malfoy in a very blatant way. And I just think Malfoy was not anticipating that because he's so used to, again, people capitulating to his rich family.
Right. So what's to stop him from doing something? He kind of feels he's probably gotten away with a lot. And he's like, oh, I'll just go ahead and do this, kind of very public. And he probably doesn't know. I keep referring to it as kid logic, you know, like, yeah. It's like, I'm going to do this and not fully thinking through the Reaper, I would guess.
Yeah. But this is the most dramatic part where, well, first of all, Lockhart's a moron and just aggravates the snake more by throwing it up in the air and pissing it off even more. Thanks.
Of course.
Yeah.
I don't want Lockhart in my hiking group and a cougar shows up.
Oh, no.
No. Oh, God. The arrogance and the, no thanks.
Harry wasn't sure what made him do it. He wasn't even aware of deciding to do it. All he knew was that his legs were carrying him forward as though he was on casters, and that he had shouted stupidly at the snake, "Leave him alone!" And miraculously, inexplicably, the snake slumped to the floor, docile as a thick black garden hose, its eyes now on Harry. Harry felt the fear drain out of him. He knew the snake wouldn't attack anyone now, though how he knew it he couldn't just explain. And Harry thinks Justin should be grateful, but is he? No. What do you think you're playing at? He shouted, and before Harry could say anything, Justin had turned and stormed out of the hall. Yeah, and now everyone is like, whisper, whisper, whisper. He's a person.
To me, this seems like every time I reread this moment, it's got to be one of the most disconcerting feelings for Harry, because... to get, like, this social reaction that is not just unexpected, but is quite literally the opposite of what you expected to happen. Like, I think that's pretty relatable, not in these exact circumstances, but you just feel like, what reality am I living in right now? Like, you can't find your mental footing. And I don't know. I think he handles it pretty well. I feel like I would have lost my mind in that moment. Like, why are you all staring at me? What the F is your problem? You know,
I think that's a great point, Amanda. Like, you have this moment where you're feeling like you did the right thing. Maybe it's because I have this moment too often in life where I'm like, I did the right thing. And then people are like, you freaking idiot. Or like, oh my God, what is she doing? It's like, I don't know. Like, I thought I was doing the right thing. So obviously that's the feeling that Harry has had. And everybody's gossiping at him because they basically think Harry is just like goading the snake on. Like, yeah, get that kid. That'll be awesome. And they're like, whoa. But what a confusing moment for, you know, Harry and for his peers.
But Ron and Hermione at least react quick enough to sort of usher him out of there. And they ultimately break it down for him that talking to snakes isn't considered a positive trait. Like in our world, the Wizarding World is saddled with a Christian demonization of snakes. And if you want to listen to more on that, stay tuned for our next Scholarly Slitherclaw episode, Harry Potter and the Christian Demonization of Serpents.
Nice. Love it.
So, yeah, it's just, I think one thing, at least in the movie, it's a testament to how much of a negative connotation parcel tongue has, is that because in the movie, they do it in a way where Harry has to order the snake several times before the snake backs off, and right. the snake is still going for Justin, and then finally it listens to Harry. So in that sense of how it's done in the movies, you can understand why there's this sort of misinterpretation. But the way it's described in the book, the way that Harry just says it once and it just flops back and, you know, doesn't rear its head or do anything, the fact that it did that so simply and still there was all this misinterpretation just is a testament of, you know, how badly this gift is viewed upon in wizarding society and how fear, you know, distorts people's perceptions of, you know, what is safe and what is not, and in turn justifies certain elements of racism and bigotry.
Totally. Yeah. Well said.
Yeah. I don't have anything to add there, but I just have a question. So this is not something that's common in the wizarding world, right?
It's usually inherited through one's family. And there are, I guess, only a handful of families who ever have been able to do it. And the most famous one being Salazar Slytherin.
Okay. Okay. I know that this is going to come in handy at some point, and I know eventually I'll learn the origin or, you know, just more about this. But right now it's just kind of, it's scary and Harry doesn't really kind of understand, but then he references back to the incident at the zoo where the snake was like, I'm headed to Brazil or something like that. And Harry's like, cool, what? So interesting moment with the Slytherin, but then this also gives Harry that moment of like, Amy, I forgot, you described it so perfectly early on, with the sorting hat, where the sorting hat said, the sorting hat wouldn't have put me here if I had Slytherin blood, but the sorting hat was basically like, you could be great in Slytherin. So this is like talking about building evidence toward the house assignment. In Harry's mind, he's thinking, maybe that was wrong. Like, maybe I'm not supposed to be in Gryffindor. Maybe this is more evidence that I should be in Slytherin.
Kevin, how do you feel revisiting Harry's discovery of parcel tongue?
Well, I don't want to say too much because I have learned a lot more about parcel tongue, but this is just another example of Harry peeling away the layers of who he actually is.
Yeah. And in that way, it makes me think of, like, could Dumbledore have foreseen this? And why didn't he tell Harry that maybe, hey, by the way, you might be able to do this. We'll see.
Dumbledore knows a lot of things that he doesn't tell Harry.
Wouldn't that have been convenient of Dumbledore to, you know, shed a little bit of light? Oh, imagine.
He's a tricky character. I like him a lot, but I have sometimes I'm like, I don't know. He knows more. He's got that glint in his eye. He knows things.
Jess, I think you are really approaching the series in the right mindset, where just speaking from someone who's going through it for the first time myself, whenever you have those lingering questions, it's good to just do what you said that you do. Okay, I'll get that answer. Because everything does get revealed. There's payoffs. There's payoffs for everything. And the payoffs are really good too.
Well, good. I am sworn to like not reading ahead. I haven't watched the movies. I'm going to wait. So because I know Amy does not want me to have any sort of spoiler. So I am keeping my promise, even though sometimes you all get real quiet and I'm like, oh, you all know something, but you don't want to say anything.
Be careful with Jeopardy, by the way. We've been watching old episodes of Jeopardy on Netflix, and I have had to like dive across for the remote on at least three occasions because of Harry Potter like series end questions.
So by the next day, Harry still feels really bummed about everyone thinking he's a psychotic serial killer snake talker. And Hermione finally tells him, you know, go talk to Justin if you feel so bad about it. And this scene really made me feel sad because I am a big fan of Ernie McMillan. I don't feel like he gets enough credit. I feel like he gets dismissed as the pompous one. And again, he and Hannah Abbott are kind of the two main Hufflepuffs of Harry's year that we know of and get any sort of screen time. So Harry goes to find Justin, and instead the closest thing he can get is a group of Hufflepuffs who are huddled together in the library and talking smack about Harry. What'd you think of this, Jess?
Well, I think if everybody, I don't know, maybe I'm speaking for, I'll just speak for myself. I think we've all had that moment where being in that group and maybe talking about something that you didn't really particularly want somebody to overhear, and then somebody overhears something. But it's just an interesting situation to be put in. You know, you kind of, the reader knows what's going on. It's interesting to have this perception from fellow Hufflepuffs. Having a little conversation about this thing that happened. And then I guess my heart kind of hurt too when I'm like, and Harry's hearing all of this and you're just like, these situations, sometimes I do this when I read or watch a show. I'm like, it just stresses me out. Like, I just feel bad for everybody involved and I cringe and it's just like, please let's get off over this. Like, let's get back to like the dueling club and fighting snakes and whatever. So my summation here is I just felt really bad for everybody involved.
I think it goes to show how, I'm sure not the first Harry Potter podcaster or Potterhead to point this out, how swiftly public opinion can change.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Towards Definitely. A celebrity that we enjoy just as much as we like idolizing a celebrity or someone, we also equally adore tearing them down.
Oh my gosh, isn't that true?
Yes.
Yeah.
What do you think, Amanda and Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a great parallel. I had never really thought about it that way. But I would like to say that even when the Hufflepuffs talk smack, they're doing it out of protection of their friend. So there's still this really lovely angle to it. But yeah, it's just a cringe few pages. You're just like, oh god, I hate this. And this is not a unique position for Harry to be in, where, you know, he's being whispered about and assumptions are being made about him, but he makes a lot of assumptions too, so you know.
And again, the whole notion of perhaps Voldemort wanted to kill Harry in the first place because he was also a pretty dark wizard and just didn't want competition rather than Harry Potter, the Jesus Christ figure.
Interesting. I'm just going to be naive at this point and not know still, because, I can relate to that. And Amanda, I appreciate that point about the Hufflepuffs. They're doing this to protect the friend. They're not being like, which we're going to talk about soon, kind of talking about Harry in a negative way, that it's kind of like, are you obsessed with me? Like, what's going on? You know? So,
right.
Yeah. What irritates me most about Ernie in this moment is Harry, again, tries, given the context of how the snake thing goes down, that Ernie is literally misremembering how things went down purely by his fear of Parteltongue and all the negative connotations that goes with that in this society. And it just unfortunately reminded me of, just in the case of, you know, arguments against the death penalty, is that, you know, 1 out of 10 people on death row are like exonerated and stuff like that. It reminded me more of a flaw in our justice system, that there have been people who've been exonerated because eyewitnesses were wrong, not because mm-hmm. they were like trying to be wrong or like had a specific vendetta, you know, against a certain defendant or whatever, but just our memories are flawed and people have gone to prison over false memories.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a tragedy. And those stories about individuals that are on death row, and you know, then they finally are released after X number of years. They're horrible and horrible, sad subject. It's absolute.
Yeah, and again, and Ernie, even though Harry's trying to like knock down each of Ernie's points, and again, Ernie is coming from the protection, from this place of protection, you know, wanting to help his friend, but as the, what is it, the Dowager Countess Lady Grantham in Downton Abbey once said, also played by Maggie Smith, you know, one of her famous quotes in that series is, love can be a, just as dangerous of a motivation as hate.
Yeah.
That's so powerful.
Yeah, which is why Maggie Smith is the best actress ever.
Yes.
So I feel bad for Harry because he's trying to, like, knock each of these points down, and Ernie just keeps firing at them. He's like, I heard you hate those muggles you live with. Like, it's not possible to live with the Dursleys and not hate them. I'd like to see you try it. And Harry just leaves feeling so defeated that he just wanted to, like, set the record straight, and it just, in his mind, made things worse, which that happens a lot in life where you're trying to set the record straight, but people are so steadfast in their assumptions that they just think you're doing something manipulative or whatever. And as someone who has dealt with this in various aspects in her current job, I don't empathize with this at all.
It's hard when people have made their mind up and then you're like, but, and it's like, no, I don't believe you. It's like, oh, okay, fine. You know, at some point, I think he just kind of did. Harry in this situation just kind of went, all right, bye. Amy, I'm sorry. We get to see Hagrid. That's exciting. That's a Yay! Positive.
With a dead rooster slinging around.
Hagrid fashion.
Yeah.
We see Hagrid for just a moment, and then what shit hits the fan, Jess?
So give me a second. So, oh yes, the strangest petrification.
Good.
Of a ghost, which is totally wild. Nearly headless Nick is just like, I love the description. I'm really trying to find it. But then also Justin has been petrified as well. So none of this is really looking good for Harry. Sorry. I'm trying
it's
to
like
find
the, it. The worst possible thing that Harry could have stumbled upon and been the first one to stumble upon it. Like, things could not be worse.
Yeah. And in this particular instance, I can understand Ernie. Like, caught in the act, Ernie yelled, his face dark, pale white, pointing his finger dramatically at Harry. That will do, Macmillan, said Professor McGonagall sharply.
And then we have stupid Peeves, who's very annoying. And he says, oh, Potter, you rotter. Oh, what have you done? You're killing off students. You think it's good fun. And thankfully, McGonagall shuts him up real quick, because that song was obnoxious already.
Terrible. Freaking Peeves.
Ugh.
And it's just funny how Professor McGonagall sets the task to Ernie McMillan to blow Nearly Headless Nick to the hospital wing with a fan.
It's so sad.
Yeah, you can't pick up and carry a ghost.
No, that whole scene is just so, I mean, bizarre. I know we're talking about like wizards and gargoyles and all this stuff, but I was just like, this is like a weird scene even for this book. It's just so wild.
It gets to a point where Professor McGonagall marches up Harry to Dumbledore's office. And thus ends chapter 11.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. And then we get into chapter 12, Polyjuice Potion, where they pick up right where we left off, where Harry is left alone in Dumbledore's office. And I forgot how cool Dumbledore's office is. There are also ASMR videos devoted to Dumbledore's office.
Wow.
I know what I'm going to have on my second screen at work tomorrow. It's pretty great.
Because I definitely want Dumbledore's desk, because it's like the Queen Anne, but like at the end, like it has the claw foot.
Oh,
yeah.
Beautiful.
Like, I just want a badass desk like that.
Yeah, I will tell you, I want Fox. That's what I want. I would I knew what he was kind of coming up on when he was kind of looking at this poor bird, and then he bursts into flames, which has to be pretty jarring to see. But I love the Phoenix.
Yeah. Fox is a special favorite of Kevin's, is he not?
He definitely is. Kevin actually, like, terrible timing, just stepped away for a second, but Kev is completely obsessed with Fox. He wants to get a tattoo of Fox. He often calls Fox his favorite character of the series. I'm like, I don't know if he's a character, but I mean,
he sure. is a character. Do not mock Fox. No, I think I remember when you were going over Chamber of Secrets that Kevin already had like a plushie of Fox and just called him his bird.
Yes. So we got it at Wizarding World at Universal Studios, and he just calls it my bird, but now he calls it Fox. So that was a huge shift. But like, now that he's gotten further in the series, he no longer refers to it as my bird.
Okay, he did evolve beyond that.
He did, yes. But it took him like 5 full books.
That's cute. And yeah, poor Harry. He just can't catch a break. He's always caught at the worst possible moments. Wrong place, wrong time. Because Fox burst into flames. But before that, Harry decides to have a little chat with the sword in half.
Oh man, I jumped past that.
No, I just love, I forgot about this, but I love how the hat starts with "Be in your bonnet, Harry Potter."
Yeah, that's pretty cute. I like that.
Like I just totally forgot about, I don't honestly use that phrase in my daily life. Like, it's only something that I would prescribe like to a character I'm writing if it's like in like, you know, Jane Austen time.
Be in your bonnet. It is a great alliterative. It's wonderful.
You've been wondering whether I put you in the right house, said the hat smartly. Yes, you were particularly difficult to place, but I stand by what I said before. Harry's heart leapt. You would have done well in Slytherin. So, how is the sorting hat defining well? Because I think the sorting hat is kind of morally ambiguous, like in the same way that Ollivander was saying, he who must not be named did great things, terrible but great.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean? What do you guys think that means when he says you would have done well? Does that mean Harry just would have been powerful, or would Harry have legitimately gone on to help redeem the house and separate it from its problematic elements?
Oh, that's a great, I was thinking about that too, because I'm thinking like you would have done well in Slytherin, and thinking, what does he mean by that? Because there are so many negative connotations with Slytherin at this point that, Amy, I think you bring up an excellent point. Maybe he would have been the, crusader to kind of change their ways a little bit. I guess that's what I kind of like to think, given Harry's, what I'm assuming his heart is in the series so far. But I think I did the thing where I'm going, I'll figure out what that hat means at some point. But right now, I'm still not sure. So I'm excited to see what that means. And I think as I get to know the character of Harry Potter a little better, I'll be able to understand that a little bit better. But Amanda and Kevin, I don't know what you think about that phrase.
Well, Amanda, Kevin, what is it like reflecting upon Harry's identity crisis, how it stands now, and, you know, just looking on it from what you know as his identity crisis continues up until the end of the books.
It's funny, going back and reading these chapters, it strikes me what a brilliant writer She Who Shall Not Be Named is, in the sense that everything that she sets up is for a reason. There's no throwaway lines. I don't think there are any throwaway plot points in the entire series, and it's really, really clever the way that she weaves everything around and kind of sets you up and makes you wonder things. And sometimes you get paid off in the next page, and sometimes you don't get paid off for 4 more books. So hang in there, Jess.
Yeah, exactly.
I also really love that question, Amy, about like, what does he mean by you would do well in Slytherin? I think I've always just assumed like you would learn magic real good, you know, but I think that it could have more layers than that. And I never thought about that before.
Because the way I think about it, like from our fanfic speculation, one of my what ifs in book one during the official sorting is what if Harry had been sorted into Slytherin and how would that pan out? And I tried to take an optimistic prediction of Harry would be able to sort of lead the Slytherins to a less bigoted way of life. First, starting off with he has social capital of wealth and everything. And so they'll listen to him when they're all nasty and, you know, care about class and everything. And so from that position, he can be a good ally.
Yeah. Yeah. That's wonderful.
But anyway, so Sorting Hat aside, Fox aside, Dumbledore finally shows up and Dumbledore gives his whole spiel about the, you know, nature of a phoenix, which don't know the exact origins. Like, I know it's a very prominent mythical figure, particularly in Middle Eastern culture and like pre-Islamic mythos and whatnot. And yeah, I don't know. It's just timeless. Like, there are so many tarot decks that instead of like the traditional card of number 13, which is death, a lot of people will use phoenix because that card is so much more not just about ending but beginning.
That makes sense. That's a cool use of that. A less scary than the Grim Reaper, I guess.
Oh no, it makes me think of Fantasia 2000, the animated clip they made for to go with Firebird.
I don't know this.
Do you know this, Amanda and Kevin?
No.
Never watched Fantasia 2000?
I have, but it's been I watched it in 2000, Amy.
Oh, okay.
That's how old I am.
I probably the same on my part.
I watched it in 2000 too.
I actually watched it when I watched Fantasia 2000. I was working at a movie theater, and sometimes they would let us screen films after hours, and sometimes we would just do it without permission. And I remember Fantasia 2000 being one hell of a party.
That had little to do with the movie itself. All right.
Right. I think I was 20 at that time, or maybe just turned 21.
Nice. I would have been 10 years old. Alrighty then. So, yeah, Dumbledore goes on. He's really very handsome most of the time. Wonderful red and gold plumage. Fascinating creatures, phoenixes. They can carry immensely heavy loads. Their tears have healing powers, and they make highly faithful pets. So, what, do you go to a phoenix breeder to get a phoenix? Like, this is never answered in the series. Like, how does getting a phoenix work?
That's a great question. And I just, you know, like, I think so highly of Dumbledore. I just kind of assumed that somehow this amazing creature made its way to a person like this. And then he's just like chilling because it's quite an amazing, I don't know. I'm equally as like, you know, fascinated by Fox. So
Amanda, Kevin, what are your theories of Dumbledore acquiring Fox with or without any hints given by Fantastic Beast and Where to Find Them, because I haven't seen them.
So Fox is my single favorite character in the entire series so far. I really, really love him. I also have a plush fox that I sleep with quite a bit.
Yeah, we were going over this when you stepped away.
I just know that you shouldn't buy your phoenix from a breeder because there are probably so many phoenixes at the shelter that really need homes.
That's true.
I kind of wonder how rare a phoenix is. Is it something that... do they live in huge flocks? Are they something that it's as easy to acquire as like a pigeon in the wild? Or is it a very rare exotic creature?
My own personal theory is that probably they're solitary birds and that they're very rare. And I have the sense that it's not just a pet, that it's sort of that Dumbledore and Fox have this sort of bond that's sort of akin to like what a lot of fantasy authors use for their protagonists and dragons, like Daenerys Targaryen and her dragons.
Yeah, or even some classic American literature that has to do with like a man and his dog, you know, like White Fang and...
or a man and his horse. Kind of and then after all of this, Hagrid bursts in. Harry didn't do it. I was just there. And he was just like, Hagrid, I know Harry didn't do it. Oh, I'll just wait outside then.
Good old Hagrid. He knows what I love how he comes to Harry's defense, but he also kind of knows, like, I better chill. Dumbledore has this. Probably does.
Yeah. And Dumbledore asks, you know, is there anything you would like to tell me, Harry?
Ooh, what a moment.
Oh, this stressed me out.
This reminds me so much of being a teenager.
Yeah. Is there anything you would like to share with the classroom, Amy? I don't know. Like, you know, Harry could have at the very least BS'd for Dumbledore and just be like, it's not fair that everyone judges me, blah, 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 just to satisfy him at least a little bit. But he's just like, nope.
Yeah, Harry is nothing if not stoic. A lot of times I think stoic when he shouldn't be stoic. I think it's kind of it's a strength sometimes, it's a flaw sometimes. In this moment, of course, like, it would be way better if he was just upfront, you know?
I guess in this situation, I'm the Hagrid. Like, I am not Harry Potter. I'm going, so this person said this to me, and this is what, I mean, I'm, my current supervisor knows, like, if I have an altercation with somebody on the phone, I call her immediately, and I'm like, okay, this is what happened. So if I'm to the point where she has helped me reword things, because I constantly almost throw myself under the bus. So saying, if I were Harry, Dumbledore would have known about those voices immediately. And he, you know, his reaction, I don't know what it would have been, but yeah, I probably would have been like, okay, you just need to calm down. But this just bothered me because I'm like, Harry, what are you doing here, man? Like, you could get some help. I have a feeling at this point, I think this is why this bothered me, is that there's some trust built with Dumbledore and Harry. Like, Dumbledore knows Harry's not just kind of, you know, being ridiculous. He knows he's got some stuff going on. So he's probably not, you know, making things, you know, being dramatic. But that phrase that Ron says to Harry, you know, it's hearing voices is just not a good thing, even in the wizarding world, like, is going through his head. And he's like, well, I don't want to say anything and get into some sort of make Dumbledore think I'm a total crazy person, or, you know, that's not the right word, but just don't have it together. He's probably not willing to risk that either.
Well, if Harry is like me, he doesn't go to Dumbledore. He just goes and rants and vents on the Discord server.
Yes, exactly.
Whatever you need to do.
All righty then. But, so, the double attack on Justin and nearly headless Nick turned what had hitherto been nervousness into real panic. No. Curiously, it was nearly headless Nick's fate that seemed to worry people most. Well, it's not curious, that's pretty obvious, because what can disrupt the state of an undead being?
Right, and it's this, yeah, I mean, to me, things that, like, escalate my fear of something is when it's really incongruent with how I think the world works, and it's totally unexplained. Like, that is terrifying to me.
Yeah.
So finally, the Christmas holidays come around, and ultimately, the Polyjuice Potion becomes ready exactly on Christmas Day. And even if I kind of wanted to, like, you know, wanted to brew an illicit, you know, concoction and use it to, like, sneak into a dormitory that wasn't my own, like, I really would not want to do it on Christmas Day.
No.
Like, couldn't we do this on Boxing Day?
Right. Right. Hermione, can we just, like, keep it bubbling for another 24 hours, please?
Yeah, this, it kind of made me feel like the, you know, the people that are doing everything to, like, pretend this thing is not a thing and we're just gonna power through no matter what. I was kind of like, well, let's just enjoy Christmas, it's supposed to be fun, right? So but whatever, they have important business to do.
And Hermione's gifts for Christmas have become much more nuanced, I should say, because before in Philosopher's Stone she just got them candy,
which I mean score, but yeah,
right,
like score, like, and I would love to get Hermione's present of a, you know, elegant eagle quill.
Sounds lovely.
Yeah, pretty fancy there, Hermione.
She's generally a good gift giver. Like, throughout the series, it's a huge strength of hers that nobody talks about, is she's a damn good gift giver. And that is a gift in and of itself. I'm a terrible gift giver.
And she, no one gives her credit for those really convenient planners.
Right.
Like, I would eat that shit up. Same. Like, I cannot live without my planner.
Yes, same.
So, let's see. Typical descriptions of Christmas merriment in the Great Hall and Christmas puddings and all good things. And so finally we get to a point where I loved this. "We still need a bit of the people you're changing into," said Hermione matter-of-factly, as though she was sending them to the supermarket for laundry detergent. I don't know why that line just tickled me. I guess just because very recently my husband was like, I was going out to the store. He's like, "Don't forget detergent." And I'm like, "I won't. We need both laundry and dish detergent.
All the detergents.
All detergents." Yeah. One thing, reading through this again, not the biggest fan of the fat shaming and equating gluttony to greed.
Yeah, that's not a good look.
No.
No, it is definitely a component of the series that has not aged well. Kevin, what do you think?
Yeah. And it's not the only time that little things like that are going to come up either.
Yeah, it's pretty cringe.
I'm just so over seeing like the idea of, I don't know, because I was, even when I'm not a Christian, like I was very in tune to like this notion of like the seven deadly sins. And so they're very separate to me. There is gluttony and then there is greed. And so I guess I'm more on the fence of understanding that eating or eating excessively is a lot of times not a question of greed. It's a matter of like emotional eating, that this brings me comfort.
Yes. Yeah. It's not really trying to take anything from anyone else, you know?
Because I've kind of been on the spectrum, not that I've had any major eating disorders or anything, but in the past, I would kind of be like, if I don't feel good, I won't eat. But, you know, kind of more recently in, you know, stress about my job and everything, I have, you know, kind of moved more towards eating rather than not eating.
Oh, sure. It can be the best comfort. I mean, like when you're sick, you want chicken noodle soup. And, you know, there's a lot of examples of food being tied to comfort, for sure.
Body shaming is cringe. You read it and you're kind of like, ugh, and then just kind of move past it. Some of the descriptions of people in here are just a little, they feel dated. So I'm glad they feel dated, because that means that we're moving past that, hopefully, in some things. But
that's a great way to look at it. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially just this one. Grinning stupidly, they stuffed the cakes whole into their large mouths. For a moment, both of them chewed greedily, looks of triumph on their faces. Then with the smallest change of expression, they both keeled over backwards onto the floor. Equating gluttony with greed, stupidity, and all every other negative adjective in the world.
I guess I was just a little distressed, like, all of that aside, just like somebody just eating a random cake somewhere was kind of like,
right? Like,
yeah,
yikes.
But ultimately, they grab their shoes, their hair, everything that they need, and dash off to Moaning Myrtle's bathroom. And so they get the cups ready. So, and again, interesting notion, Apologies Potion, like, its color will change based on the person or the essence of the person you're pouring it into. So Millicent Bulstrode, like that potion, turns yellow. And then the Goyle concoction is some sort of, like, I don't know, what is it? Like grayish bogey color, I guess. And then the crab one is like this dark, murky brown.
Nothing sounded like super to ingest.
No.
And so they drink it and they transform. So, Kevin, Amanda, if you had the choice to transform into anyone, who would it be?
Oh, wow. What a good question. No one is coming to mind that I would like want to transform into, but if I knew it was temporary, I think I'd like to know what it's like to be a dude. You know what I mean? Like just experience that it's got to be just such a different, I don't know. That's the only thing that comes to mind for me.
I think I'd want to be Shakira.
Yes.
That'd be fun for sure.
What about you, Kevin?
I think I would want to be that mountain climber from the documentary Free Solo.
Oh my God.
Alex, I can't remember what his last name is.
Alex Honnold, you just stressed me out all in like a moment.
Me too.
That guy's amazing. With his free, like the free climbing of El Capitan, that in that documentary is fascinating. But so I think I read like mice and, you know, critters will like climb up on his arm, or I think he talks about that. Can you imagine like having your being on that wall and just have this mouse run down your back? Like it just, I would be a goner. Good for him. But no, that's an awesome one.
I hate that. I hate it.
And so Harry and Ron are ready to go, but Hermione stays behind. We'll find out at the very end. But they trot on over. Okay. For all of Hermione's prep of like getting the extra robes from like the laundromat or whatever, and all of these things, they didn't figure out where the common room was beforehand.
God, that's such a good point. I never realized that.
Like I don't think I really thought about this in my rereads either, but I'm thinking they have invisibility cloak. They could have just followed any Slytherin at any time just for like, you know, 20 minutes tops just to figure out where it is.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, had Hermione not stayed behind, I guarantee you she would have gotten them there way faster.
True. That's something that I wondered in this situation, like these little mistakes that Ron and Harry make. How much of this was just like Hermione had this figured out and she was just like, I mean, I'll be there. So I'll just guide you, you know? And there was a little bit, she's embarrassed for reasons that we'll talk about. And there's a bit of urgency too, right? Because this stuff only lasts like an hour, I think. So that was kind of how like I rationalized some of these things away, because I was like, I think that there would be some more information, but I'm just trusting that Hermione would have known, and then we're, you know, that's why the mistakes happen.
But ultimately, Harry and Ron are relying on Crabbe and Goyle's stupidity, because again, this is the only way that this like scheme can be pulled off, is just Malfoy thinking that they're both so dumb that this is totally normal.
Right.
And so Harry and Ron are disappointed that it is not Draco Malfoy after all. And not only that, is that his father is being very limiting in the information that he provides Draco.
Yeah, it's like, I'm going to teach you, presumably, how to cast a snake out of your wand, but I'm not telling you anything about the Chamber of Secrets.
Still not. And, ugh. It's just, I guess one thing I'm really creeped out about is, you know, Malfoy says that, you know, a pure blood, or he says, like, the last time the Chamber of Secrets opened, a mudblood died. I hope it's Granger. And again, why Draco hates Hermione so, so much? In many ways, it comes off, depending on how you interpret it, that he hates Hermione more so than Harry. All the Draco Hermione fanfic.
Yeah, it, probably some inherent sexism, probably, you know, I don't know. But I also thought that this is a little, I was like, that's dark, man. Just like chill, you know, it's a good thing I am not at the school, because I'd just be telling everybody to just calm down all the time, I guess. But
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So part of this makes me think of, you know, part of our like Patreon only like scholarly Slytherclaw episodes is comparisons between Harry Potter characters and Game of Thrones characters.
That's awesome.
So we already did Hermione Granger versus Arya Stark.
Wow. Who won?
Not so much. It wasn't so much winning, just comparing smart girl archetype versus cool girl archetype.
Oh, interesting. I was thinking of it like a head to head. I think this chapter is getting to me.
Yeah. We did talk about it at the very end. Jess thought Hermione would win, and I thought Arya would win.
Ah, yeah. It's a tough call.
Yeah. But in this one, I always thought about, okay, it's, you know, at a later date, like, depending on how, like, you know, how far we get in each character's history and whatnot. But at some point, there will be a scholarly Slytherclaw episode about Draco Malfoy and Joffrey Baratheon.
Nice.
Oh, yeah, that's a...
And also Dumbledore versus Lord Varys.
Ooh.
Man, I'm having to go back to, I know who Varys is, but I'm trying to see Mind's Eye and I can't right now.
Anyway, I digress. And then again, the very sad, you know, article that Arthur Weasley got fined 50 galleons for the flying car debacle. Again, which made me sad. I like, you know, they don't have that money. Like, where did they carve this out?
Right. I'm just glad he didn't get fired. I had to reread that twice because I was like, did he lose his job? And I'm like, okay, there isn't any indication that he lost his job. He owes them a lot of money. And, you know, we know the Weasleys, that's not something they have a lot of. So that was a bummer.
I was trying to be grateful that he still had his job.
You know, and it's, I think it's one thing to say about, again, the prevalency, even though there isn't a Lord Voldemort, you know, running around wanting to terrorize, you know, like the clan, but that still that we, you know, in the article, Draco's father is like, Weasley has brought the ministry into disrepute, Mr. Malfoy told one reporter. He is clearly unfit to draw up our laws, and his ridiculous Muggle Protection Act should be scraped immediately. Yeah, just the idea that, you know, again, you're in a prime opportunity to, like, discredit your, like, rival, nemesis or whoever, and he can't think of, like, more intelligent language to use, if you know what I mean. Again, like, part of the conservative part, you know, certain conservatives within America is like, you know, if I was a conservative, I would be doing everything within my power to, like, you know, step away from everyone who was using any type of, right, racist or classist or whatever, you know, rhetoric, because just to give myself a little bit of credibility. But Malfoy doesn't even need to do that. Like, this is just accepted and this is okay.
Yeah. Yeah. We're here. I mean, you really said it all, though. I mean, like, I can't add anything that you didn't just put so eloquently.
Yeah, but anyway, so that's key things they learn. Poor Arthur Weasley and is fine. Malfoy isn't the heir. He doesn't know who the heir is and only knows that a mudblood died before. And he found out there's a secret chamber in the drawing room at the Malfoy's house, which Ron is going to cling to like a dog with a bone.
As would I, because that is some great intel. I loved that. I love that they're like, so he gets this little bit of information. Because, you know, Malfoy's kind of like boasting, you know, to his two friends. And I have a Chamber of Secrets too. And it's like, oh, cool. And they're like, oh, yes, we know this. Because Weasley, Ron is, I'm sure he's feeling, you know, he's just got kind of kicked with, you know, this news about his father. So I'm sure he's just clinging to that information.
And soon after this, the potion starts to wear off and they skedaddle up back to Moaning Myrtle's bathroom. And again, not a great look for Moaning Myrtle taking far too much pleasure in other people's suffering.
Oh God, I know. I have such a problem with Moaning Myrtle just in general.
It's just the only thing that brings her joy is, you know, Schadenfreude.
Yeah, yeah. Which, I mean, is relatable, but still.
It doesn't have to be so gleeful about it. And, you know, it's ultimately Hermione shows her face and she's like, it was a cat hair, she howled. Millicent Bulstrode must have a cat and the potion isn't supposed to be used for animal transformations. And so I like, not that I enjoy Hermione's suffering, but I kind of like the showing that even though Hermione is absolutely brilliant and did all of this stuff, like stealing from Snape and creating the cupcakes to drug to Rufy Crab and Goyle, like she's still a 12-year-old and made a very simple mistake.
Absolutely. Right. Poor thing. I feel so bad for her.
Yeah, I can't imagine how she looks. And like I said, I'm trying not to watch any movies or anything like that. But I also wondered how long or short Millicent's hair was, because I mean, I don't know.
Because a cat hair, even a fluffy cat hair, you know, if her hair was longer, she could have maybe she has really short hair. We don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. I definitely don't know.
I wonder what would have happened if Hermione had put one of her own hairs by accident in the potion.
Oh, whoa. Like Inception, Hermione whoa. Inception.
Just got meta.
Maybe she would like get to know herself better.
Stop it. She would get
in. I like that.
I love it.
And thus concludes chapter 12. Any further notes, Amanda and Kevin?
No, I mean, what a action-packed couple of chapters. You know, Harry goes from being like neutral, pretty well-liked guy to being a pariah at the school. And Hermione goes from being a human to a half human, half cat by the end. I mean, it's like, wow, it's a lot for two chapters.
So I guess we can move on to Gothic Geek Out. So Jess, what were your thoughts on these chapters?
I mean, we all know from from the gothic thing that I love a ghost. Like, so the amping up of a petrified ghost is like the combination of a statue with its eyes moving. It's just so bizarre. Like I said, I'm a little fixated on how strange this is that I feel like the weirdness of a petrified ghost, it is to me one of the more gothic things in there. I feel like there are little elements of the gothic, you know, even Dumbledore's office could be considered a little gothic too. And Snape's potion room, all of those things. But I'm just going to cling to the petrified ghost this go round. How about you, Miss Amy?
I didn't even think of Nearly Headless Nick in this instance, because again, I'm just so used to like seeing the ghost not as like quote unquote scary gothic. They're just such a neutral part of the school.
Right.
My most gothic thing, the Slytherin common room.
Hmm. Very nice.
Yeah. Just the whole, and again, a lot of ASMR Slytherin common room things as well.
It's oddly specific.
Yeah. Yeah. Like they, like for all the houses, like I got into ASMR, like, cause when I'm writing, like I can't, it's hard for me to like have like words, like people singing, like I just need it to be instrumental. But then also like having like, you know, rain sound or fire crackling. And so like I look these up.
That's great. Yeah, I'm with you. I can't listen to anything with words if I'm trying to concentrate on something.
So for me, it was the Slytherin common room because, again, all the sort of imaginings of it is that it's dark. It has like the sort of green fire and candles surrounding it. And it's part, and in a way, in some places, I think it's part aquarium because it's under the lake.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely. That's really cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's all I had for Gothic Geek Out. So now we can move on to Tarot of the Day. So I'm shuffling them right now, my special Druidcraft Tarot deck. And okay, let's see, which card is it? My card is the Ten of Cups. Okay. Which is a very positive card. I just know from off the back, holds a lot of positive connotations, which is quite interesting for this drama-ridden chapter. So here, just give me a minute while I search up its definition just in more detail. Like, I read the tarot cards, but again, I don't have them all memorized yet, at least.
That would be quite a skill.
There are 78 cards.
Oof.
The Ten of Cups embodies happiness, joy, and emotional contentment, particularly in your relationships and family. You have created an abundance of love and happiness in your life, and you now share this love with others, expanding your heart even more. This card often appears when you are surrounded by your loved ones with whom you share a powerful and deep connection. You appreciate and support one another, and together you help each other reach your highest potential. It brings you so much joy to see your loved ones succeed and live happy lives. Okay, very interesting to put, like, Jess, what do you think? What can you pull from this chapter?
I'm just going to talk about, you know, we kind of touched briefly on Christmas at Hogwarts and Hermione's gift-giving skills. So that kind of the family is not necessarily your blood family. It's kind of sometimes can be the family that you make. So I'm just going to apply that to Ron, Hermione, and Harry, and just kind of the camaraderie they have. You're right. It is a very positive card for such, you know, kind of dark and dreary chapters. So that's my hot take right there.
Love it.
My take on it, because part of the Ten of Cups is encourage you to follow your heart and trust your intuition to lead you to opportunities. So the only way I can relate that to any of the darker stuff is Harry's instinct to tell the snake to get away from Justin.
Oh, yeah.
That's good.
Nice.
Yeah.
So that's the only thing. What do you think, Amanda and Kevin? Can you pull out anything else?
The only other positive thing that comes to mind for me that's sort of like a little sparkly bit in the midst of a lot of darkness is just all of Dumbledore's background about phoenixes and just Fox in general. You know, it's like Harry's in Dumbledore's office in such a state of panic and self-doubt, and then we get this really kind of lovely description of this healing faithful companion. It's a nice moment.
This is true. I didn't even think of Fox. That's a good one.
Yeah.
So I just pulled out, or Kevin, did you have anything to add?
No, because I was going to bring up Fox also.
Sorry, I took
of
it.
Of course you were. Okay, so again, we're also going to do Rune of the Day, where I just pulled out the rune. And again, because I'm so new to this type of divination, is I do not know what this one, what the name is or what it means. So I have to go look it up. Just give me a minute. The rune is called Pairthrow. And it has like, it's like a line with like some squigglies. It's hard to describe. I may have to put a picture in the description notes, but the name is Pairthrow and the keywords for it are mystery, secrets, revelation, and chance. Of all the runes, this is the most mysterious. Its meaning has never been agreed upon by scholars, but the symbol is often interpreted as a receptacle used for casting lots, such as modern day dice cup. As such, you know, Pairthrow is associated with divination and the use of the runes as a means of discovering hidden knowledge. Drawing this rune can indicate that things are not quite as they seem and that something previously unknown is about to be revealed. So, what can you guys glean from this rune? Much more relevant than Ten of Cups.
Yeah, I mean, I instantly think things are not as they seem. I instantly think of Ron and Harry, who are actually Ron and Harry, but who look like Crabbe and Goyle.
What about you, Kevin?
Yeah, there are a few different things that play in here, especially Jess talking about the parcel tongue. So just some of the unknown things that you as a reader don't know yet.
Yeah, interpret that as just kind of like very a good one for the series at large, really. There's this kind of ever-present mystery happening that I hope to find out sometime.
You will.
Me? Yeah, my biggest one was the notion of revelation, just the big one that Harry is indeed a parcel mouth and that there's all sorts of mysteries and superstition that goes along with that as well.
That's absolutely.
Alrighty then, so enough with forms of divination, and now we shall go to fan fiction time. Alrighty, so Amanda and Kevin, what were your scenarios?
So we have one collectively.
That we agreed on and discussed before we got on.
Yes. And okay, it's gruesome and dark.
Yeah.
So cool. What if Harry had been just a couple of seconds too late and that snake had actually physically attacked Justin?
Wow.
Ooh.
Would Harry have been pulled into, like, you know, for questioning about this? Like, what would have happened?
Right.
What if the snake would have killed Justin Flinchy Flinchley?
He has so much trouble with this name.
Why Justin can't you deal with his name, Kevin?
What is the deal?
And it doesn't help that there's also a character named Filch.
Right.
Right.
Filch Flinch Flinchley.
So if Harry, you know, had been too late. Well, first of all, that begs the question of, even if the snake had bitten Justin, would that, again, note their notion of bodily harm, like, would that have been the usual pretty traumatizing but still healable? Or would the snakes, depends on the type of snake that Malfoy conjured. Is this a cobra or like mamba that can kill you in like minutes or what?
Yeah, or like, are wand snakes like different somehow and like more lethal and don't follow any rules? I don't know. That's what's so cool.
Yeah, so definitely it would not bode well for Harry, I don't think, just with all the negative connotation. That is, like, this is the craps Harry's getting when nothing, quote unquote, happened.
Right.
So imagine just what would happen if something actually happened.
I like that. I like that, you know, in our past podcast with all of us, I took a really dark path. So I think it's really interesting. And also, like, you know, part of me thus far in the series, like, Harry has a tendency to get out of these situations that we really think he's going to get a lot of heat for. Now, if a person dies, I feel like the Ministry of Magic would be involved in some capacity. But
it's an interesting thing to think about, like, if that situation would have taken a turn that was much, much darker, Harry definitely would have been marked, for sure.
Okay, then, Jess, what was your scenario?
I feel like, so based on the reaction that happened when I went so dark, I've kind of gone a little lighter now. So I was just thinking, so with the Polyjuice potion, what if it had gone wrong the way that Hermione's had gone wrong? You know, like, what if Harry accidentally had one of Scabbers furs, you know, and or, you know, one of Hermione's cats, whose name, I'm so sorry, it's Crookshanks. What if they all just would have turned into animals somehow, and just, or, you know, had that weird metamorphosis where they were like half animal instead of, you know, turning into Crabbe and Goyle? How much would that have set them back? How frustrated would Hermione have been with her, like, potion making skills? I feel like it would have just been like this really tense moment for the three of them.
I think it would have also, well, again, I think it all factors depend on how much the Polyjuice potion is good for, because we kind of don't really know if it can sit and age or if aging has any impacts. So in terms of how much they're set back would depend upon is the Polyjuice still usable for the foreseeable future? Would Madame Pomfrey be as forgiving in her usual don't ask questions if all three of them showed up with animal faces? As much as I love Pomfrey and stuff, and I'm glad that she's like, don't ask, don't tell, I think if it was all three of them, then maybe she would have been a little more scrutinizing and that would have set them back more.
Yeah, Jess, you could also spin this into some furry fan fiction.
So, okay, I'm gonna give you full credit for that. I am not taking credit for that tonight, but that's awesome.
What about you, Amanda?
Oh, I mean, I just think it would have been wicked cute. That's the only thing that comes to mind for me. Like, oh, that'd be kind of adorable.
Amy, did you have a fan fiction? I think you're the last one to write.
Honestly, I forgot to think of one, so let me think of one real quick. So, Dueling Club, I guess one thing. So, what if Snape would have beat Lockhart to a pommel?
Ooh.
In the Dueling Club.
I would have felt very conflicted, because I would have been happy because Lockhart was pummeled, but I wouldn't have wanted to celebrate Snape.
What about you, Kevin? Do you hate Lockhart or Snape more?
Ugh, that's a tough one. I feel like Lockhart may be a little bit more innocent than Snape, but I'm also really fascinated. Remember I told you that Fox is my favorite character in the series?
Several times.
Snape is, I think, in my opinion, the most interesting character in the whole series.
Okay.
Endlessly fascinating.
I thought you were about to say your second favorite character and we were going to have problems.
So, yes, this is true. Snape is a multi-dimensional character. And so, I don't know, I guess it just would beg the question of, you know, given all the we've already gotten plenty of evidence that Lockhart is a little bit of a buffoon, but if Snape were to just publicly humiliate Lockhart on that scale, like, would it cause more people to question, or like, would it put Lockhart in a position of, you know, thinking, oh my god, like, I'm exposed or whatever? Like, I don't know.
That's a good point. Yeah, it might have put him out kind of like in the open a bit more, I guess, because I feel like his lack of proficiency in this moment is still kind of explainable in the eyes of the students that are like big fans of his.
Yeah, so it's just, are you guys familiar with the Cinema Therapy YouTube channel?
No, what is that?
So apparently it's a really good channel, relatively new, where this filmmaker and a therapist get together and watch movies and analyze them.
Oh, cool.
And instead of, they have yet to do any of like the actual, like, each film, but they did do one shorter video specifically all about Lockhart and narcissism.
Love it.
Yeah. And so the idea is that, you know, as the therapist in the channel pointed out, is that Lockhart in many ways is shown as being like the sort of innocent type of narcissist. But how innocent or like harmless can they be when their image or whatever bubble they've put themselves in, when that pops and when their image is exposed, like what will they do after that exposure happens?
Interesting.
Yeah, that's narcissism is a fascinating topic. I'm going to have to watch that because it's got my wheels turning.
Yeah, it's a really great one. They've done really great videos on Soul, Inside Out, a whole bunch of things. Alrighty then, cool. And that concludes the Rambling Raven Pups for chapters 11 and 12. Thank you so much for joining us, Amanda and Kevin. It was a blast as usual.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you guys.
Thank you.
Yes. And Amanda and Kevin will join us in the next season for another episode in The Prisoner of Azkaban. And if all goes well, they will join us for at least one episode of each book.
Woohoo! Awesome.
Yay.
And then next week, we will be doing chapter 13, The Very Secret Diary, and chapter 14, Cornelius Fudge. And then chapter 15 afterwards, Aragog, we will be joined by Morgan Chalfont again. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Thank you.